From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. By the time Saul Bellow won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1976, he had already populated American letters with a menagerie of characters you couldn't help but root for. 50 years ago,
from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The controversial herbal stimulant ephedra will be taken off the market. Federal health officials say they plan to ban products containing ephedra early next year. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson announced the decision to ban ephedra. For too long, he said, dietary supplements containing ephedra have been heavily promoted and widely used.
FDA is issuing a consumer alert on these products, warning everyone of the dangers that they pose.
Ephedra has been linked to about 150 deaths and to thousands of adverse effects, including strokes and heart attacks. Ephedra supplements have been marketed to dieters trying to lose weight and to athletes who are trying to boost performance. The herb works as a stimulant that raises blood pressure and stresses the circulatory system. A spokesman for the American Herbal Products Association says there are alternatives to ephedra. One being marketed for weight loss is a green tea extract. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Attorney General John Ashcroft has removed himself from the Justice Department investigation into who revealed the name of an undercover CIA officer to the news media. Deputy Attorney General James Comey said the investigation will be run by Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney in Chicago.
Mr. Fitzgerald alone will decide how to staff this matter, how to continue the investigation, and what prosecutive decisions to make.
The investigation began last summer when the identity of undercover CIA agent Valerie Flame was disclosed by syndicated columnist Robert Novak. Flame is married to former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Wilson has charged that someone in the Bush administration revealed his wife's identity as retribution for Wilson's comments that the administration exaggerated Iraq's nuclear capability. An Israeli helicopter gunship fired two missiles at a car in the Gaza Strip today. Hospital officials said at least 11 people were wounded, two critically. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
An Israeli army spokesman confirmed the airstrike and said the target was a militant from the Islamist Hamas movement who apparently escaped injury. The attack occurred near the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood in Gaza City, a Hamas stronghold. Last week, Israeli helicopters launched missiles in Gaza, killing three Islamic Jihad militants and two civilians. Prior to that, Israel had not launched any airstrikes for 2 months. An end to Israeli assassinations was one of the key demands by Hamas in ceasefire talks earlier this month in Cairo. Those talks fell apart without an agreement. Also today in the West Bank, Israeli troops re-entered the West Bank city of Nablus just hours after they pulled out. They carried out house-to-house searches looking for suspected militants. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks, the Dow lost 25 points to close at 10,425. The Nasdaq gained 3 to 2009. This is NPR News. Traffic is moving again on snow-covered Interstate 5 in Oregon and Northern California. Heavy snow led to hundreds of motorists being stranded on a 150-mile stretch of the highway for hours yesterday. Donna Appadoni reports from member station KXJZ.
The winter storm that hit the West Coast and closed Interstate 5 from southern Oregon to Redding, California, subsided after 24 hours and 2 feet of snow. The interstate and other main roads have reopened, according to California Highway Patrol Officer Scott Christensen.
Well, I-5 is open and traffic is able to go through. We're asking everyone to still be cautious because, there could be times when they can get slick.
The storm also brought 3 to 4 feet of snow to the central Sierra Nevada during peak holiday ski season. National Weather Service officials report a winter storm watch is already in effect for Northern California on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. For NPR News, I'm Donna Appadoni in Sacramento.
Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman says the government is banning the use of sick or injured cattle for human consumption. Cattle that are too sick or hurt to walk on their own are known in the industry as downers.
Effective immediately, USDA will ban all downer cattle from the human food chain.
The decision follows the discovery of a downer cow in Washington state that had mad cow disease. The cow's meat was sent to market but later recalled. Veneman said the decision is not likely to cause beef prices to rise because downer cattle make up a very small part of the food supply. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're continuing our holiday series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway, by cheating just a bit and hearing from songwriters who have written great songs for kids TV. The late Jeff Moss was one of the original writers on Sesame Street and composed many of the best-known songs on the show, including I Love Trash, The People in Your Neighborhood, and Rubber Ducky, which was a top 40 hit. What Cole Porter was to Ethel Merman, Jeff Moss was to Miss Piggy. He received an Academy Award nomination for his songs in the film The Muppets Take Manhattan. Moss also created the characters Cookie Monster and Oscar the Grouch. In 1998, Moss died of colon cancer at the age of 56. Back in 94, we thought it would be fun to hear the composer sing some of his own songs, so we invited Jeff Moss to join us at the piano in our studio.
Why don't we start with the song that's your chart buster? It actually made it to, I think, number 16 on the Billboard chart.
Something like that, back a few years ago. The highest on the charts ever, I think, for a song sung by a guy in a bathtub. A rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Vovodio, rubber ducky, joy of joys. When I squeeze you, you make noise. Rubber ducky, you're my very best friend, it's true. Oh, every day when I make my way to the tubby, I find a little fellow who's cute and yellow and chubby. Rub-a-dub-dubby, rubber ducky, you're so fine. And I'm lucky that you're mine. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of. Rubber ducky, I'd like a whole pond of. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you.
Great. I should have been squeezing it in the background, right?
In fact, it was I who was squeezing it in the background
on
those
record.
Many years ago on the record, yeah.
So how did you write the song?
Well, depending which story I tell, either it was very late at night and I was there alone in my tub with my rubber duck just overcome with the poetry of the song, or I had created a character of the rubber duck for Ernie, and it was just, he loved it. It was his passion, his obsession, and it just overflowed that way.
And Jeff Moss, you were one of the original writers on Sesame Street. When you signed on to do the show, was it understood you'd be writing songs, too, and that songs would be an important part of the program?
In fact, we thought that songs might be an important part of the program, but no. Joe Raposo was the original music director, and we found out we were going to use records, and we found out because it was public television, it was very hard to clear the rights to use them. So Joe came to me and said, well, look, you write words and music, I write words and music, why don't we just do it? We'll write to the curriculum, we'll do it faster. Joe was wonderfully ebullient. He said, we'll do it better, let's just go do it, and we did it.
Were you already writing songs? Did you have confidence you could do this?
Oh, sure.
What kind of songs had you been writing?
Well, from the time I was 9 or 10, I'd been writing songs to, entertain my friends. And then in college, I'd written the musical comedy stuff in college. And then my first job, which had been at another children's television show called Captain Kangaroo, I'd written a lot of songs for there.
Huh. So now you were also in on the creation of some of the characters,
mm-hmm.
like Cookie Monster.
Indeed.
And Oscar.
Indeed.
Tell us about creating Cookie Monster.
Well, Cookie Monster, Jim and his people had created the physical monsters before Sesame Street, but they had always been quite scary, and they never spoke. But they were just such wonderful
puppets that I went into somebody's office one day and said, well, how about that furry blue one with the boggly eyes? Could he maybe talk? And they said, well, you know, the puppeteers don't talk very much and they're scary. And so I said, well, what if he doesn't talk very much and I try to make him funny? And they said, well, go ahead and do it. And I wrote a bit for him in which he had two words, and one of them was milk and the other one was cookie. And we were in the studio and Frank Oz performed him just so brilliantly we all fell off the seats, and I went back and started writing more.
Oh, I think this is a song cue. Why don't you do a Cookie Monster song?
Yeah, this is what he has for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, but he sings about breakfast today. He says, me have a soft boiled cookie with a glass of cookie juice on the side, or for a change one morning me will have me cookie scrambled or fried. It isn't hard each morning to keep me satisfied. Just give me a soft boiled cookie, please, with a glass of cookie juice on the side.
That's great. So was the voice your idea or Frank Oz's idea?
Oh, no, that's a poor imitation of Frank Oz, whose idea it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, you co-created Oscar.
Co-created Oscar, yeah.
And how did he come about?
He came about because the educators had suggested that we have a character who showed kids that it wasn't necessary to be cheerful all the time. So a grouch was created, and it was decided that he lived in a trash can, and then we sat down and kind of created this wonderful vicious circle for him where if you make him happy, he hates that, and that makes him unhappy, but being unhappy makes him happy, so he likes that, but that makes him unhappy, etc., etc., etc. Meanwhile, he has his obsession and his passion, which is Oscar sings,
oh, I love trash, anything dirty or dingy or dusty, anything ragged or rotten or rusty, oh, I love trash.
I like the idea that you put that in waltz time.
Yes, indeed. It was a good juxtaposition of trying to write a pretty waltz for a yucky character.
Did educators ever object to the fact that he was an unsanitary puppet?
Do you know, they didn't. But we think that today, if we were creating today, they might have. You know, they might have worried that kids would crawl in garbage cans and all that. But they never did, so the writers feel that the kids can discriminate. Educators test it out. We don't.
When you were younger, you had ambitions of writing Broadway musicals?
Well, in fact, I probably did, yeah. I grew up, I guess, during the late 50s, and I can remember my father was on the stage. My father was an actor, and I can remember.
Really? Would I know him?
Arnold Moss, his name was, and he was a Shakespearean actor. And my earliest memories are theater memories, and I can remember The King and I and that kind of stuff. But by the time I was old enough to try it, it kind of was going in a different direction than it had been going, and I found Sesame Street, and that's the direction everything went.
Broadway, I imagine, was going in the ersatz rock direction?
It was going in rock, and it was going in the area where the songs were less important, where the production was much more important, and Bob Fosse's and Tommy Tune's and those people who were brilliant, but they were the stars. They were the people who were using, you know, the Gershwin songs rather than the new writers' songs.
Now, you got to write a Broadway musical in the sense that you wrote the songs for The Muppets Take Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
which is about
Absolutely.
The Muppets going to Manhattan to do
a Broadway musical,
show.
Yes, at the Biltmore Theater.
did you get a chance to write the kinds of songs for that were very close to what you would have written for the stage?
I don't think so. They were more the kinds of songs that I would have written if I had been doing the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies
right.
of the 30s, which is another way that one might look at Kermit and Piggy. And the show that they put on was a very glitzy Broadway show. But there was jazz in that score that I wrote. And there was rock, and there was waltzes again, and kind of ragtime.
We got an Academy Award nomination for the songs that you wrote for The Muppets Take Manhattan. Let me ask you to do one of the songs from there. It's a song you wrote for Miss Piggy about how she wants to be a movie star.
Yeah, she wanted to be everything and love her man at the same time. She's saying, I want to be a movie star, and I want to learn to drive a car. I want to be a veterinarian, too, and I'm gonna always love you. And she's saying, I'll be the cutest model you ever saw, and then I think I'll study criminal law. And I'm gonna learn to scuba dive, too, and I'm gonna always love you. Went on, and she wanted to climb the Matterhorn, but only after all her children were born. And she wanted to be a good mommy, too, but I want to always love you.
We're listening back to a 1994 interview with the late Jeff Moss, one of the original writers on Sesame Street. He also wrote many of the show's best-known songs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1994 interview with the late Jeff Moss, one of the original writers on Sesame Street. He wrote many of the show's best-known songs. He joined us at the piano in the Fresh Air studio.
Now, your first job after college, I think, was working on Captain Kangaroo as a
production assistant.
What was the job description?
There was no job description. The woman who hired me said, well, we have jobs for production assistant. You could choose either the CBS News or Captain Kangaroo. And I was being very young and flip, and I said, well, I've seen the news. And I hadn't seen Kangaroo, and that's where I ended up.
So you didn't grow up watching Captain Kangaroo?
No.
I'll confess, I never liked the show when I was growing up. I couldn't understand the attraction of what seemed to be an old man wearing overalls. and it was such a non-urban show to me that I just never related to
it. Well, it wasn't non-urban, though it did have a moose who liked to drop ping pong balls on people's heads, which was not urban, but neither was it particularly rural. But it's funny. It had a lot of funny stuff in it and a lot of educational stuff that I guess maybe we didn't realize or the people who made the show didn't realize that it had. And I did that for 6 months and then came back as a writer for a couple of years. And it was a very nice place to begin.
So when you got the job on Sesame Street, were there things you felt you wanted to do different than the way you'd seen it done on Captain Kangaroo?
Everything about Sesame Street was new. The great thing was that we had a marvelous freedom that we didn't realize we had then. This is looking back on it. But Joan Cooney had raised a lot of money that couldn't be paid to anyone in salaries but could be spent on production. And we didn't have a network that we had to please. We didn't have stars that we had to please. We didn't have sponsors that we had to please. And we were committed to doing 130 hours of television. And there were four of us wrote 90% of the first year's show. And we could just have the most wonderful time as long as we were willing to work 37 hours a day. And we just did whatever we wanted to do that stuck to the curriculum. In the early years when I was head writer, I used to say to the writers, look, the two jobs you have is one to keep the 3 to 5 year old watching the TV, and the other one is to write a show that if you were spinning the dial, you would stop and watch yourself. And that's what we did creatively from the very, very beginning.
Was every song supposed to carry a lesson with it?
Yes, and almost every song did, and almost every piece of material on Sesame Street did and does.
Do you have a song that's your favorite lyric for teaching something in a really entertaining way?
Of the recent songs that I've done, we began doing racial relations as a goal a few years ago, just several years ago, and they wanted a song that would kind of be the corner post of that. It's a film of kids at the beach, kids playing at the beach in their bathing suits, and this is the way I chose to deal with it.
skin covered all over with beautiful skin. Skin covered all over from ankle to chin. Lovely skin on kneeses and noses and everywhere. Skin on tummies and toeses and under your hair, it's even there. Oh, skin, wonderful colors and beautiful tones. Skin, think of without it, you're nothing but bones. Skin is ever so lovely no matter the color you're in. Let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin, let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin.
No, who sings that on the show?
It's the voice of Kevin Clash, who's one of the Muppets, but it's just a film of the kids playing at the beach. It's not a Muppet song.
That's a good song. Another of your little Tin Pan Alley numbers.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of kids' music did you grow up with? Did you listen to real music or kids' music when you were young?
You know, I don't think they had kids' music, whatever that is, when
I remember
was
having
young.
Like little red records and little yellow records about here comes the circus.
I remember classical music played a lot. I remember large 78s with green labels of you know, tango music. And I remember show music. I remember, you know, as I say, The King and I. But I remember Beethoven, Chopin. I don't remember kids' music.
What about rock and roll? When did you start hearing that?
I started hearing it when Bill Haley started doing Rock Around the Clock, which would have been the very, very late 50s when I was a teenager.
And the impact that had on you?
You know, at the time, I guess I tended to at least pretend to be above it. And then when it got to be the 70s, I realized that my ambition had always been to sing in a 50s rock and roll group. So I created that opportunity for myself on Sesame Street and created Little Jerry and the Monotones and wrote the first bass part a half note lower than the bass of the Muppets could sing. And then I just hung around and joined a 50s rock and roll group.
Well, you've been writing more books lately. And your new book is called Hieronymus White. Tell us a little bit about the story, and then I want you to read the beginning of it.
Yeah, Hieronymus White, it's subtitled A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right. And it's about a bird who comes to believe that he always was right. It begins, goes back to way before he was born, when his parents are very young, and goes through to the point that his granddaughter has grown up. And it shows the good things about believing you're always right and the bad things, and it traces his life and comes to a point where something happens that causes him to no longer believe that he's always right. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right. He was always an expert, whatever the task. He would share his advice. There was no need to ask. When his children came down with a fever or chills, he'd order the doctor to choose different pills. When the postman delivered a package or letter, Hieronymus told him how he could do better. He approached every issue so confidently, he'd seem shocked at the thought that you might not agree. Yes, all through a life that was famous and long, Hieronymus thought that he couldn't be wrong, till one day late in life when his feathers were thinning. So now let's go back to the very beginning. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right.
I really like that. I'm sure I know this character.
Yes, I think we all do.
This character has given me too much advice over the years. So what inspired you to write this story?
I think I wanted to write firstly about a person who believed that he always was right. I have known a number of them in my life, and sometime I don't have to go too much farther than the mirror to find one. And also, I wanted to write about continuity and about passing things on from one generation to the next. And I began the story, and it kind of took off and became what it became.
Let me get you to do a short, grumpy poem from a previous collection of poems called The Butterfly Jar.
This is called Hi, How Are You Today? I'm feeling very horrible and low and mean and mad and dreadful and deplorable and rotten, sick and sad and nasty and unbearable and hateful, vile and blue. But thanks a lot for asking, and please tell me, how are you?
Very good. Well, it's really been a pleasure.
Me too.
Having you here on the show. I've really enjoyed it a lot. I'd love for you to end with a song, and you have actually a very sweet song about goodbyes. Maybe you can do that. Tell us first how you wrote it.
It's from The Muppets Take Manhattan, and it comes at a time when the Muppets are not being successful in their quest to become stars on Broadway, so they all have to split up and go in their various directions, and this is the song they sing. Saying goodbye, going away, seems like goodbye is such a hard thing to say. Touching a hand, wondering why, it's time for saying goodbye. Saying goodbye, why is it sad? Makes us remember the good times we've had. Much more to say, foolish to try. It's time for saying goodbye. Don't want to leave, still we both know. Sometimes it's better to go. Somehow I know we'll meet again. Don't know just where, and I'm not sure just when. You're in my heart, so until then, want to smile, want to cry, saying goodbye.
Jeff Moss recorded in 1994. He died of colon cancer in 98 at the age of 56. More songs from children's TV in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Washington and Caesar, a novel set during the American Revolution by Christian Cameron. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Coming up, more songs from children's TV. Jazz pianist, songwriter, and singer Bob Dureau talks about his songs for Schoolhouse Rock. They include Three is the Magic Number and Conjunction Junction. And we listen back to a 2002 interview with the late Fred Rogers, recorded at the piano.
I got and, but, and, or. They'll get you pretty far. And, that's an additive, like this and that. But, that's sort of the opposite. Not this, but that. And then there's or. O-R, when you have a choice like this or that. And but and or get you pretty far.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two boxcars and making them run right. Milk and honey, bread and butter, peas and rice.
Hey, that's nice.
Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing your shoe and a button or two. He's poor but honest, sad but true. Boo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two cars to one when you say something like this. Choice, either now or later, or no choice. Neither now nor ever.
Hey, that's clever.
Eat
this or that, the growth in or fat. Never mind, I wouldn't do that. I'm fat enough now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're continuing our holiday series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway, by taking some liberties and hearing from composers of songs for kids' TV. Schoolhouse Rock was a series of educational animated videos with clever songs designed to teach kids about grammar, math, and history. It was broadcast Saturday mornings on ABC from 1973 to 85. The song stuck in the minds of some popular rock musicians who grew up watching the series. They paid tribute with new versions of the songs on the 1997 CD Schoolhouse Rocks. What many of the people who grew up with Schoolhouse Rock don't realize is that the music director of the series was the jazz composer, pianist, and singer Bob Dureau. He wrote and sang many of the Schoolhouse Rock songs. In 1996, he told me how he got involved with Schoolhouse Rock.
Well, let's see. I had met advertising people who concocted the idea. And my partner, Ben Tucker, in fact, wanted us to write a little advertising music. He's a bass player, Ben Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
So one day, this gentleman from McCaffrey and McCall Ad Agency said, "We're looking for a guy to put the multiplication tables to music." And Ben Tucker said, "My partner, Bob Dureau, can do anything. He can put music to anything. Well, let's have him up." So I went up to meet the president of the agency, and it was his idea, and his name was David B. McCall of McCaffrey and McCall. He said, "My little boy can, sing along with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, but he can't memorize his multiplication tables." So I had the idea, why not put the multiplication tables to rock music and call it Multiplication Rock? What do you think? And I said, "Well, yeah, that's pretty interesting." And he said, "Well, but don't write down to the kids." Well, I learned later that he had invited other Broadway songwriters to do this task, and they came up with a more simple doggerel type of songwriting, writing down, as it were, to children.
So when he said, "So what do you think?" What did you really think?
I thought, well, yeah, this this could be, a limited idea. But when he added, "Don't write down to children," the hackles on my neck arose, and I got quite intrigued. And so I agreed to tackle it, and I spent about 3 weeks before I would let myself write the first song. I thought first, looked in math books, and since I picked my first title, it was called Three is a Magic Number, I even looked in magic and occult books for the reasons that three might be a magic number.
Did you get anything from those books that you used
indeed.
In the song? What'd you get?
Mm-hmm. Well, that it was one of the magic numbers, and that it was, embodied in certain things like the Trinity, the old sayings, the heart and the brain and the body, faith, hope, and charity, trinities of sorts. So I got mainly that, trinities. And, of course, I also was an admirer of Buckminster Fuller, so I was thinking of his triangle concept that makes construction so strong.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your version, the original version of Three is a Magic Number. Now, did you sing on this one?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we hear it?
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number. It takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand. It takes three wheels to make a vehicle called a tricycle. Every triangle has three corners. Every triangle has three sides. No more, no less. You don't have to guess. When it's three, you can see it's a magic number. A man and a woman had a little baby. Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number. 3, 6, 9. 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18.
Now, when the advertising executives ask you to set the multiplication tables to music, did they already have, had they already known they could broadcast it on ABC TV?
No, they were thinking of a phonograph recording and a book. The idea of television wasn't remotely in their heads.
So how did it get on TV?
Well, after some time of testing the songs and having the product called Multiplication Rock, they didn't seem to be getting anywhere in the book publishing world, so one of the executives up at McCaffrey & McCall said, you know, one of our clients is ABC Television. I mean, we do their advertising. Why don't we present it to them? And so Mr. Tom Yohe animated it. They did it at their own expense. It's very expensive to animate a three-minute song. And they presented it as an animation film to ABC, at which point suddenly we were in that business instead of the book business.
Now, what I'd like to do is play one of my favorites, and it's My Hero Zero.
Did you ever stop to think about zero? Zero is fantastic. Why, without the concept of zero, we'd never be able to multiply, divide, add, subtract, or even to count very high.
My Hero Zero, such a funny little hero, but till you came along, we counted on our fingers and toes. Now you're here to stay, and nobody really knows how wonderful you are. Why, we could never reach a star without you, Zero, my hero. How wonderful you are.
What's so wonderful about a zero? It's nothing, isn't it?
Sure, it represents nothing alone, but place a zero after one, and you've got yourself a ten.
See how important that is.
When you run out of digits, you can start all over again.
See how convenient that is.
That's why with only 10 digits, including zero, you can count as high as you could ever go.
Forever towards infinity. No one ever gets there, but you could try.
Now, do you think most of the people who grew up listening to your songs, do you think that they have any idea that these weren't written and performed by people in advertising agencies or theme houses, that they were written by you, an interesting and eccentric jazz performer, and that the other songs, some of the other songs on here, are sung by interesting and eccentric jazz performers?
Yes, well, I'm sure they didn't even think about such things. They grew up and they learned and they watched. They were a captive audience, one of my partners pointed out, George Newell, because, you know, they were watching Saturday morning cartoons, and suddenly there would be this little three-minute film, and they got hooked on them, and it actually did them some good. And as we went on in our productions, I kept bringing in some of my buddies from the jazz world. So it was a kind of a, a little bit of a underground movement there.
Bob Dureau recorded in 1996. His latest CDs are Too Much Coffee Man and Who's On First, a live recording which also features Dave Frischberg. Coming up, music by Mr. Rogers. This is Fresh Air. Today we're featuring composers who wrote great songs for kids' TV. Writing music isn't what Fred Rogers is most famous for, but his songs, his piano playing, and singing were an important and delightful part of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Last February, Fred Rogers died of stomach cancer at the age of 74. In 2001, after 33 years of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, he recorded his last program, but the program lives on in reruns on public television.
Last year, Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave spoke to Fred Rogers, who was seated at the piano in his studio in Pittsburgh.
You write about a lot of everyday things. You also write about some pretty profound issues in parenting, about children's fears. I'm remembering a show you once did about how a child cannot go down the drain in the bathtub. You had a whole show about that.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds funny, but you're really meeting kids on their own level. That's a real fear. Did a child write to you, and is that where you got the idea for that?
A child played that out in front of me one time, making a character, trying to see if that character could go down a tube, you know, just a plain, ordinary tube. And I found out that it had to do with the drain in the bathtub. That child was petrified when his parent pulled the plug while he was still in the tub. And so consequently, we wrote a song about that, you know. You can never go down, can never go down, can never go down the drain. And then it goes on, you're much bigger than the water, much bigger than the soap. And it's true, but children don't know that when they hear this loud rush of the flush of water in the bathroom. They think they might be sucked down the drain. And so just to talk about it, people were very surprised that I would show a bathtub drain as well as a toilet drain and just say, you see, you could never go down such a small thing. Well, there were many children, I think, who breathed a sigh of relief just to be able to talk about it.
I have to ask you about the sweaters, and I'm sure you were asked about the sweaters that you wore on the show many, many times. But I understand your mother knitted most of them until her death.
She did. Mother was a great knitter. She would carry her knitting bag wherever she went. And she made a sweater a month. And at Christmas time, she would give 12 sweaters to this sort of extended family of ours. And invariably, she would say, okay, here's your sweater for Christmas, and here's the pattern book. Tell me which one you want for next year. Of course, I know the one Freddie wants. He wants the one with the zipper down the front. Well, I have all of those sweaters, and we used every one that she ever made for me. But that's been kind of a trademark, hasn't it, the sweater and the sneakers. And the sneakers came about because I had to run across the studio floor to get from the puppet set to the organ when I was doing the children's corner. And so the sneakers just became, I didn't want to make a lot of noise by running in other shoes.
What were you like as a kid?
I was an only child for 11 years, Barbara. And I had to make up a lot of my own fun.
I think you were sickly often, right? You had a lot of childhood diseases?
I had every imaginable childhood disease, even scarlet fever. And so whenever I was quarantined, and you know, they used to quarantine people for chicken pox and all of those things, I would be in bed a lot. And I certainly knew what it was like to use the counterpane as my neighborhood of make-believe, if you will.
You mean
but
the,
I had
the,
puppets.
The window? You would use, what, finger puppets or shadow puppets or what?
And things on the bed. I would put up my knees and they would be mountains, you know, covered with the sheet. And I'd have all these little figures moving around and I'd make them talk. And I can still see my room. And I'm sure that was the beginning of a much later neighborhood of make-believe.
Was King Friday the 13th one of your childhood characters, or Lady Aberlin, or Lady Elaine?
The king probably had his his genesis there, but it wasn't that particular name, because it was a child who helped us form that name, King Friday the 13th. A child had been told that Friday the 13th was a very bad day, and he was afraid of those Friday the 13ths. And so I just said one time, why don't we have a character whose name is Friday the 13th, and he celebrates his birthday every time a Friday lands on the 13th.
Oh, that's so unfair.
And so his birthday, King Friday's birthday, is always every Friday the 13th. And I hear from people all over the world. You know, it's a joyous occasion for us. It might be otherwise for those who haven't been enlightened by the neighborhood. But
This is King Friday the 13th. I must explain a few things to Miss Beebe.
Yes, you're certainly welcome, King Friday.
Friday the 13th is a fine day, and may you not say otherwise. Thank you.
Oh, it's taking me back. Now, well,
this is Lady Elaine Toots. You ask about me, and I'm mighty glad you did. Have you ever been to my museum go-round? Well, you'll find everything that you could ever want in any one of those rooms.
Oh, this is X the Owl. You seem to be speechless, Barbara.
So true.
I'm just flying around here looking for you. There's Daniel Tiger over at his clock. Did you want to say hello to him? I mean, he's awful shy.
So,
well, I am shy, but I would like to say that I'm glad you're having fresh air.
Oh, thank you for that. So is that how you spent the weeks when you were in your bed as a kid, making up voices?
Yeah. Voices for puppets and all kinds of stories. And then when I was 11 years old, my sister came, and then I wasn't an only child anymore.
Now, did you have a model for your Mr. Rogers persona, the perfect adult, and someone you knew, maybe your father, your grandfather, or?
Well, my grandfather McFeely used to say things to me, the kinds of things that I would say to the children on the air. We would visit him at his farm. Every Sunday we'd go out there for dinner.
McFeely as in Mr. McFeely on your show.
Exactly, yeah. And that's my middle name. And that was my mother's maiden name. But we would go to his farm for dinner on Sunday, and invariably he'd take us for a walk around the grounds and say things like, I'm so glad that you come. And when we leave, he would say, you've made this day a special day. Things like that, you know, that just your being yourself is what matters to me, and he would take me fishing, and he was a wonderful person.
We're listening back to Barbara Bogave's 2002 interview with the late Fred Rogers. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're featuring interviews with the composers of great songs for kids' TV. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave recorded last year with Fred Rogers, who died earlier this year. When they spoke, Rogers was seated at the piano in his Pittsburgh studio.
You worked with the people on your show for decades. Many of them stayed for decades, right? And I was thinking that when people work together on a television show for so long, they often play some practical jokes on each other on the air just to keep things interesting. What kinds of pranks happened on the set of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Did they ever sprinkle itch powder in your sweater or anything?
No, but there were times when they put rolled-up newspaper in the toes of my shoes so that when I was singing the goodbye song, I would try to get on my shoes, and, of course, they were much too small for me to get into. So the camera didn't show the shoes those days, and I was going out with my heels over the backs. And then one time there was this blown-up, voluptuous lady made out of rubber in a huge one in my closet when I opened at the end of the program to put my sweater back in the closet. Here was this lady waiting for me.
What did you do?
We taped it over. But you couldn't do that in the days of live television. And, of course, that's the way we began. We began a daily program, an hour a day, live, and we did that for 8 years. And that was called The Children's Corner with Josie Carey. And I did the puppets and the music for that program. And it was all ad-lib and live. And a most wonderful way of learning how to talk when the red light went on.
I have to get you to tell this story. I understand once the actor Michael Keaton was on your show. You had many celebrities on the show, but he made a little bit more mischief than most.
Michael worked with us on the studio crew before he ever went to Hollywood. And he was in charge of the trolley, the movement of the trolley in my room, and also picture-picture. And so there's a little sliding door right under picture-picture where I put in the tape. And so
this is the magic picture projector, right?
It has a projector,
a slot.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And one day I opened the slot to put the tape in, and I heard this voice say, "I'm ready to hear your confession, son." Well, that was Michael. And those are the kinds of things that he's just a wonderful person.
There have been many spoofs of Mr. Rogers, as I'm sure you know, over the years. Eddie Murphy's on Saturday Night Live is perhaps the best known spoof. I remember National Lampoon also had a skit based on your show. What did you think of those? How did you feel about the ribbing you got over the years?
I think most of them were done with a great deal of affection. I remember meeting Eddie Murphy for the first time over at the RCA building. And he came out of his office, and I was walking down the hall, and he put his arms around me, and he said, "The real Mr. Rogers." And Mr. Carson, when I was with him one time, he said, "You know, Fred, we would never do these takeoffs about you if we didn't like you. We wouldn't care about making you famous."
It's been wonderful to have you at the piano while we've been talking. Perhaps you could sing something for us or play something for us. Maybe not necessarily a children's song, but something you play for your enjoyment to take us out.
It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends.
Oh, Mr. Rogers, thank you so much for talking today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Barbara. Wish you well.
Fred Rogers spoke with Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave last year. He died earlier this year at the age of 74. Tomorrow we continue our series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Barbara Cook singing Baby Mine, a song from the animated Disney film Dumbo. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dutton, publisher of The Lady and the Unicorn, the new novel by Tracy Chevalier, author of Girl with a Pearl Earring, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
On the next Fresh Air, our series Songs from Hollywood and Broadway continues with an interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. He wrote many of Sinatra's songs from films, including All the Way and Come Fly With Me. Also, singer Margaret Whiting, daughter of songwriter Richard Whiting. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Come fly with me, let's float down.